welcome to Agency Phonics. My guest is almost here. Talk about good timing. Welcome everyone to Agency Phonics. We've had untold amount of technical problems this morning. We tried to get into the studio, but clearly because we've been away from the studio, everything has seemed to have disappeared this morning. And so after half an hour of trying our best to find everything, we've decided to give up. And we're now testing out StreamYard for the first time, which is going to hopefully help us with our LinkedIn Live and live streaming. We've been using Skype for a bit, and we have a few streaming issues on that working for us. So we're going to switch platforms now, for those of you who are interested in the technology behind the show. So I'm Spencer Gallagher, and today I have a wonderful guest. In the wonderful Daryl Scott, who has been a dear friend for a good few years now, and I can't wait to get into my conversations with him. You know, if you in business have ever suffered personal challenges, psychological challenges, you know, personality issues like imposter syndrome or confidence challenges, anxieties, fears, anything that's kind of held you back, then really, and you know, and stopping you becoming the leader or the founder that you want to become, then Daryl is the man you need in your life. And we'll talk more about what he does shortly. But first of all, as always, just a quick thank you to a few people. Thank you to Warhive for today letting us use their office instead of the studio, and all the things they do behind the scenes just to help and support us. Also, our sponsors, Forecast, who is the project management software to use in your agency business. And Forecast have been a wonderful supporter of everything we do at Agency Phonics, the not-for-profit social enterprise, and Agency Nomics, the community. And if you're listening to this and you're not in the community and you're a founder of an agency with more than three owners, go to agencynomics.com and please apply to sign up. We're approaching 1,000 members in the community now, which is wonderful, with agencies from sort of 3,000 to 3,000 employees. So it's a really great place to be. So it's Christmas. Well, it's almost Christmas. This isn't the official Christmas edition, Daryl, because otherwise I would have tinsel here everywhere. I've got the Christmas cactus with us today because the Agency Phonics sign is behind me and too big to stick in front of my laptop. But I don't know about everyone else out there, but I'm feeling pretty worn out. It's been a hell of a year this year, a roller coaster of a year. It's certainly been had its ups and downs, an emotional roller coaster, and maybe even a work roller coaster as well. So I'm sure, like me, many of you are really looking forward to having a prolonged break over Christmas. I don't like wishing time away, but these next 2 weeks couldn't come any quicker, in my opinion. So before I sort of start really to intro Daryl, I just want to share with you just a short story, really, to sort of set the scene. Daryl and I recently, we actually did a questions and answer session, didn't we, Daryl, in the community? Mm-hmm. And actually, the whole thing went down so well, we decided we were going to do a podcast as well. But I shared the story in there, but I want to share it again really with everyone listening, because I know not everyone in the community will be listening to this show, especially if you're working in an agency. So there's sort of two lessons initially. The first one is, you know, sometimes just listening to the serendipity in your life. I went through, I think it was probably around, was it about 2010 when I first met you, Daryl? Yeah, so I think around 2009, 2010, I kept meeting people who kept saying, "Do you know Daryl Scott? You should meet him." And I think in life, whenever people say to you, "You should meet someone," then I think, you know, sometimes you've got to listen to the universe telling you what to do. So I kept hearing his name. So rather than just thinking, "Yeah, whatever," I reached out to Daryl, tracked him down, and said, "Hey, everyone says I should meet you. Let's meet up." And as it turns out, he lived a couple of villages along from the one I live in Hampshire by coincidence, which was really great because we got to meet at the Four Seasons and we had a wonderful chat, didn't we, Daryl, for felt like an hour and a half. And then a couple of years later, I'd had a bit of a bad run of luck at work. I think a couple of people really let me down. And I remember turning up to the train station in Winchfield, which many of you will not have heard of. And I was feeling a bit crap that day. I had bad days too. And I try to be upbeat most of the time, though. And I met Daryl and I said, "How are you?" And normally, you know, when someone says, "How are you?" I'm like, "Yeah, I'm amazing. You know, I'm brilliant. I'm always that kind of very positive, optimistic person. But I remember that morning going, yeah, you know, I'm not that great, actually. I'm feeling a bit crap. And he was like, what's wrong? And I said, well, it's just whenever people let me down, like when people kind of, you know, sort of, and I'd had a couple of instances where I'd been let down quite badly by someone, and someone had tried to sort of rip off me on in an investment I'd had. And I just felt a bit like I was always trying to help people, but, you know, maybe it wasn't feeling very reciprocal. And Daryl goes, you know, I can fix that, right? And I was like, what do you mean you can fix that? Like, fix how you feel. And I was like, well, that'd be really good, because I had this anxiety over me. Like, it was, you know, like a kind of sick feeling that maybe you get sometimes when something bad happens to you, personally or professionally. It's almost, I always kind of relate it a little bit, Daryl, sometimes that feeling you get on a Sunday night when you're in the job you hate and you've got to go to work the next day is a nauseous feeling. And anyway, he said, come and sit with me on the train. So we jumped on the train, and it was full up. I mean, we're talking rush hour here. We're talking, I mean, there were standing people. I mean, the carriage couldn't have been fuller, right? But we got a seat, and I'm sitting there, and he starts instructing me to do some really weird things. I'll share some of them without giving any of his magic away, I think. But he's like, you know, you're sitting back in the chair and point to the future and point to the past and, I don't know, just a few other things. Close my eyes. And everyone's sort of clearly unconscious that everyone must be looking in at what's going on. But he sort of takes me through this very short story. And at the end of it, he said, open your eyes. You kept saying to me, oh, yeah, ignore the train doors opening and shutting at one of the stops. Although I think you told me it was only one stop we went on. Okay. It felt like it was the whole train journey to London, if I'm honest. And I opened my eyes up and he said, so how do you feel? And I went, it's all gone. I was like, where's it gone? Is that permanent? And he went, yeah, it's gone now. I went, and I was like, do you remember? I started giggling. I started actually, like, I was like a little kid. I was like, no, that can't. I've been feeling really anxious for like at least the last 3 or 4 days, and it just all gone. And I was like, that's amazing. And then you actually said, so, you know, and you brought up the two names of the people that I felt had really let me down, had left me feeling in this position of anxiety. And he said, how do you feel about so-and-so? And I went, I just don't care. And I was like, and it was just amazing. And it was the first time, I guess, I realized that actually there are a lot more techniques out there, clearly, than most of us know about, to sometimes improve some of the anxiety, some of the things. And obviously I'm married to someone who's just started to become a hypnotist as well. So I've started to see evidence of some of those things as well. But clearly you weren't hypnotizing me alone. You were doing a lot of other things combined together from what I've gathered over the last recent years. So that's my intro to Daryl. I've got a few more stories I'll share with you. But so it gives me great pleasure to welcome the legend himself, Daryl Scott. So Daryl, welcome. Can you give us a little bit of a background on kind of your story and, you know, how you got to where you are today? I know you've recently, you know, been working, or in fact, you've had quite a good agency pedigree, but I'd particularly like to know about your journey from, you know, when you were over in America and how you got into all this stuff.
Oh, man. Okay. So I was an agency owner very young, in my mid-20s to sort of mid-30s. And it was great. You know, I started an agency on my parents' dining room table, and I grew it to about £1 million inside 3 years, and then onward, and built a team, and suffered from horrendous imposter syndrome at the time.
Does that actually mean, Daryl, quickly, imposter syndrome?
Well, I don't know.
What did it mean to you?
Feeling that you're blagging it, or you're going to get found out, or, you know, it must be luck, or, you know, surely I can't have achieved all this. You know, it's going to go wrong at any given moment, you know. And I did that crazy thing as well, where I took a really agile agency with a lot of very, very empowered people, and because of my imposter syndrome, sort of put a load of process on it and killed the spirit of it, and actually messed up profitability for a little while. You know, there was a lesson to learn there. However, in that period of time, I to overcome my imposter syndrome, if you like, I started to invest in myself and did a postgrad in strategic management and other stuff. And I discovered this thing called NLP. You know, one of my friends had been become a trainer and said, yeah, come on this course, you'll love it. And I sort of had the bandwidth. And I did, and I got bitten by the bug. I, you know, absolutely loved it. And suddenly, for the first time ever, this sort of this philosophy or this way of thinking about how human beings work that really makes sense. And it's actually, you can do something with it, like rather than a load of psychology knowledge that's all very interesting but not particularly helpful. It was incredibly practical, which worked for me brilliantly. So I became a kind of a nerd. I became, you know, obsessed and a bit of a Wally, you know, with NLP stuff. Would talk about it at any given opportunity, and went through a period of learning how to be a master practitioner and then a trainer. But along that journey, I met a guy called John Grinder, who was my hero. They say you shouldn't meet your heroes because they kind of disappoint you, but he didn't. He's amazing. He was if you Google him or whatever, look him up. He's this legendary guy. He was in the CIA. He was a Cold War spy. He's a professor of linguistics in University of California. He speaks 11 languages fluently. And when I met him, he was 70 years old. And he was still like climbing frozen waterfalls with axes and riding horses bareback. And he's like.
From memory, there's two people that founded NLP, and he's one of them, right? So is it two or three?
Well, there were three originally, yeah.
A lady as well, and then Roger Bandler, is that right? Richard Bandler, yeah. Sorry.
You can call him Roger if you like that, I don't mind.
I'm sure he isn't listening to this, so I won't worry.
There was this other guy, Frank Pieslick, as well.
Okay.
Over the years, but... Grinder was the professor of the group. He was there. He was the older, wiser one, if you like, who at the time was being tutored by a guy called Gregory Bateson. He's this amazing bloke. I won't bore you with the details. I go on this journey. I meet this John Grinder guy, this absolute legend who created NLP. And he took me to one side and he said, I think you're quite good at this stuff. And if you want, I'll mentor you. So I thought it was a really good idea. So that provoked me to sell my agency and go on this kind of NLP journey for the next, whatever, 12 years.
It's also worth sort of pointing out as well that John Grinder also was quite famously mentored Tony Robbins as well. So it was quite a privilege to have him to select you out of all the people he works with to mentor, right? He obviously saw something in you.
Quite a few people of notoriety. So I think I'm a huge disappointment to him.
I'm sure that's not the case.
Yeah, well, I don't know. But I mentored between 2008 and 2012, and I wrote a few books and had a few adventures, and it was brilliant. And it left me with a sort of an understanding of this stuff that's a little bit different to the norm. I guess that's the story. And then since then, I've just been playing games. You know, I did leadership development stuff for Pret A Manger and Virgin Atlantic and Deloitte and companies like that, and had an opportunity to sort of get into the C-suite in large organizations and really understand how that worked over a decade of consulting. Come back into agency world, mainly your fault sponsor, and played some games there and had some adventures. Became a shareholder of an agency for the last 5 years that has had a brilliant kind of period of growth and exciting change. That's my story.
Amazing. So if Pete was supposed to be here today, but because of the late start, unfortunately, he had another meeting in the middle of the day, and we didn't want him to walk out halfway through the episode. And so, but he always also shares a story about you, which is, you know, he, in fact, when we grew the business, whenever he went on a holiday, I didn't really clock this, which is probably sounds a bit weird, but he always was the person who he always drove on holiday. And I didn't know why he was always driving. In fact, his wife and daughter would fly to the south of France. And he would drive. And I just thought it's because he loved driving, honestly, because he does love driving. And he loves cars. But it turns out I had a massive fear of flying, just hadn't really told anybody. And he'd obviously for many years been going to see a hypnotist. And he had some tapes, and I noticed that whenever I got on an airplane with him, he would literally be hanging on to the person next to him, the seat in front, and he had this horrendous fear. And And then I think he'd have a little whiskey at the beginning of the fly, you know, and every little bump, it was like, you know, it was like panicking beyond belief. But it did get better with the hypnotist. It got definitely improved slowly and slowly and slowly. But it wasn't until I think one day we bumped into you. And then I think you did some magic with him or something very quickly in the middle of a rest bar, which is actually another funny thing we should talk about in a moment. But and actually he then got on a flight with me after that, and he's never ever been scared of flying since, which was quite a transformation to have someone who was so scared, who wasn't fully fixed, but now I would say he is completely fixed on flying, you know, although he still likes a little drink on an airplane, but then who doesn't? So, but actually that was, I think, and so, you know, your ability to fix things is obviously quite far reaching. And so is there some examples of the sort of things that you typically do help people with?
Yeah, with the specific stuff like that, like, you know, I'm scared of spiders, I don't like flying, is incredibly easy. You know, it takes minutes to change that kind of stuff. I think, you know, the more challenging things are the more difficult to identify the trigger. You know, the things that, you know, the low grade anxiety or the general sort of clinically cheesed offness or whatever, where there's not such an obvious trigger and you've got to dig a little bit more. There's not really any limit to what you can change. You know, it's what you want to.
I mean, that's really one of the things I want to talk to you about in a second. But I mean, just to sort of let listeners know the sort of things where I've wheeled you in before. I think certainly where people have needed to become more confident. I mean, I work with a couple of owners now who are running multi-million pound businesses who you were coaching quite early on when they were probably just lacking a little bit of confidence. And maybe imposter syndrome was part of that. I don't know. But it was still just more around, you know, or sometimes where they were trying to be almost over. I think the example I like to give to people is where people are sort of won't do anything because everything has to be perfect. And I think you used to use this phrase, how good is good enough or something, with that person to make them sort of, you know, not be so obsessive about things. But I once had to go to an agency in Scotland, listeners, and there were three founders in there, and all three of the founders were scared of speaking. And it was a wonderfully successful creative agency in Edinburgh. And I was, of course, doing my usual coaching and mentoring, saying, guys, you've got to build your personal brand. You've got to get out there. You've got to speak with expertise. But they were like all terrified of being able to do that. They all had, I think, some kind of childhood trauma of speaking. So I convinced them, and this is really the point of the story, to get to actually get them to Daryl, to, you know, for them to see Daryl. And Daryl went up there and you did some work with the three of them. And I flew back about a month later and two out of the three were speaking at an event they were hosting. And it was, you know, it was a big audience. It was probably 75 people in the audience. Yeah. And they both spoke. And I just couldn't believe the transformation from there is no way I'm talking. But what was amazing about that was that they were prepared to change. And I think they were prepared not to accept the fact that this was something that was holding them back, Daryl, you know. And a lot of people don't want to, they know what the problem is, but they don't want to fix it. Does that make sense?
Yeah. I mean, one of my favorite expressions is, you know, if you defend your limitations, the prize is that you get to keep them. You know, well done. But the Edinburgh guys were pretty, the most satisfying thing was that of the three of them, the guy that was the most reluctant, 6 months later, did a speech at the House of Commons.
Wow.
It's like, oh my goodness, you know, one extreme to another.
And I have to say to you that it was a journey for speaking for me. Like, you know, it started off with a team of one and then a team of six. And then it was maybe a round table of 12 and then maybe an event of 30. And then one day you walk in and no one's told you there's 200 people and you're like, oh, and you speak to 200. And And there is a thing that helps build confidence if you do it in a nice, logical, you know, slightly increasing, increase out of your comfort zone each occasion. But I had to speak at the Houses of Parliament last year in a debate, and it was the first time ever that I choked. I literally, my mouth went so dry. The flight part of me was just like, and luckily someone brought water out because I couldn't speak. And I realized actually it doesn't matter how good you are, there's always going to be some limit where you're going to be tested, and all of a sudden you've got to be prepared for it. But now I've done that, I guess it's another level of breaking through. But yeah, I didn't know that about him. So that's a really good story. So why do you think it is that so many people aren't aware of that they can fix so many of these kind of psychological problems, like anxieties? And there's so many things that can be treated through NLP and through sort of, you know, advanced hypnosis, I'm going to call it, CBT is another thing that's quite commonly used, I know, these days. I mean, why is it that maybe it's not so commonly talked about or used? Or do you think people just don't really allow budgets for themselves to invest in these things?
Well, I mean, yeah, but my experience is, almost like going to the dentist, you know. People will be motivated when it becomes an acute problem, you know, and causes them discomfort, and then they'll throw money at it. But in general, everything.
Yeah. So until the problem's big enough, people don't really want to fix it. It probably makes sense, actually.
Yeah, so people don't tend to think of these kind of things as performance enhancers. They think of them as, like, you know, solutions to bigger problems. The ROI case for getting good at speaking, you know that more than me, Spencer, obviously, but
yeah,
it's a pretty pretty solid return on investment to invest a bit of time and effort and money in getting good at that.
Yeah, I think no question that, you know, improving your performance will always deliver a return on investment. I mean, I think that's a given, but I understand what you're saying. It's almost like, I think we said this the other day on the Q&A, it's the difference between maybe a sports, an athlete. An athlete will invest continually on self-improvement, on their performance, whereas business people, you know, obviously I work with certain people who are working with me to improve their performance. And I find the most successful chief execs actually are the people that do that. The ones that don't want to do that, who maybe express some kind of like, yeah, they know everything, they don't need any outside help, actually often the ones, you know, they don't tend to succeed as quickly. I mean, I'm not saying they can't succeed, but there definitely is something around being more open to learning. And is that an imposter syndrome? Is this imposter syndrome, you don't want to almost admit you might need help, whereas most good people need help, right? We all want help.
Yeah.
I mean, we can all improve.
Without a mentor, no one ever really made it without guidance. You know, you can't just get a genius and instantly succeed.
Yeah, I mean, Tony Robbins had Jim Rohn, and you know.
Yeah, so everyone who's serious about performance invests in it, right, and sees it as an investment rather than a cost, and has mentors. What prevents you? I don't know. I mean, maybe it's seeing it as a cost. You know, trying to hack it and do it yourself. Maybe it's maybe it's just that, yeah, you see it as some kind of personal failing if you need help, you know, which of course it's the opposite of the truth.
Yeah. So I mean, on the more comical side, I remember that we met at a hospital club once, and I just popped to the loo, and some guy had just joined us in our conversation. He'd overheard us talking about presentations or something, and I popped to the loo and I came back and he was slumped in his chair.
Yeah,
like, Daryl, what have you done? He goes, well, I've just hypnotized him. He's just got a few things I need to fix. And I was like, you can't just go round in restaurants and bars and hypnotize strangers. He said, don't worry, I'm fixing him. That was quite hysterical. But I think people don't really, there's definitely a thing around hypnosis, the catch 22 of kind of people almost not believing in it. Or doubting it, I guess, because the stage stuff gives it a bad name, you know, in many ways. But actually, it's a bit of a self-fulfilling prophecy, isn't it? Because if you don't believe in it, it won't work for you, because you have to almost commit yourself to the process. And I mean, is that a problem, or for you, do you face that sort of trying to convince people that actually you can help them?
Yeah, well, I've never met anyone I can't hypnotize, but the perception of
water. You've never met anyone you can't hypnotize.
No. You do sometimes need a bit of a variety of techniques, so that people respond to different things. But I don't do much hypnosis. It's generally not very necessary. It's better to just engage in a very surface level kind of daydream of imagination where you're much more compos mentis. So that whole kind of like, 1, 2, 3 sleep. The only time I ever do that is on stage, for farts and giggles, really.
Yeah.
I certainly don't do it in coaching. I'll do something that's much more conscious and much more, mindful and much more imaginative. So.
But it's funny because I have found it. I've obviously, because my wife does a little bit of it, I actually found it quite useful. And I shared the story the other day about how I got her to hypnotize me because Pete, he was here so I could share the story with you, but he decided last year he wanted to run from his house in Farnham to his house down in Poole, which was 90 miles over 3 days. And at that point, I think I'd run about 12 miles maximum. But I was like, you can't run all that way by yourself. Like, it was the hottest day of the year. I said, you're mad if you do that. I said, I'll come and do it with you. And of course, having not run that far for quite a few years, I was a bit worried. So I said, Leslie, could you hypnotize me? So the night before, she hypnotized me and said to me that I had the fitness of a 21-year-old, and that every time I touched my fingers, it would get easier. And also, if I said each mile 3 times, the next mile would be easier. So it was like each day around. Actually, it was two days. Get my numbers right. It was about 2 days. It was 65 miles. That's just what it was. So it was like, mile 33. Say it 3 times. And then the mile 32 would get easier. I was sort of counting down. Anyway, do you know what? Pete will tell you, he sort of quit halfway through on his own challenge. And I managed to run the whole way over 2 days. And it was just unbelievable just how the voice in my head was almost shut away from doubting. Does that make sense?
I've got this mental picture now, like this hypnotized Spencer skipping along a poor old Pete.
I've got a photo of him lying on the floor, completely passed out, and me going, come on, Pete, let's go. We got him a bike in the end, so he actually got on a bike and recycled with me. But it was, to be fair, it was a pretty horrible time. So do you think that also there's an education piece around what you do? Like, it always feels to me, like that day I met you, I've been in business a long time. And the day I met you and I was feeling like a bit, low and stuff, and you made a massive difference. I was really positive after that, upbeat, and it almost got rid of some of the things I felt that were holding me back. But there is this education piece because I didn't know that could be done, right? Now, since that's happened, I've kind of tuned into it a bit more and I've sort of listened to other people and I've listened to stuff on NLP and things like that. And I'm now aware of a lot more, but it just feels like it's almost a bit of a secret sometimes.
Yeah. Yeah.
Why is that?
I honestly don't know. It's a cause of frustration. You see fields like education, embracing all kinds of things from NLP. You can't go on a leadership development program or an executive coaching program that isn't heavily, heavily influenced by NLP. I just think it's, fundamentally at the bottom of this, there is this misconception about how we work. We think that we're these conscious animals that go around thinking all day long and having intentions of deciding what we do, and we have an occasional emotional outburst, whereas the reality is we're these emotional creatures that are driven around all day on autopilot, all these kind of patterns of unconscious programmed behavior and emotional reactions, and occasionally we have these little moments of consciousness and thoughtfulness. So when you begin to really think about how we work as a human being, it's all about our unconscious associations and it's all about our emotions, but we try to think our way out of everything, and you can't think your way out of a pickle that you've got yourself into by how you think. It's a paradox. So I also think systemically, fundamentally, and you can believe this or not, I don't know, but I believe from my experience that performance comes from culture, because having a strong culture, a strong sense of what to do, it makes decision making quicker, it gets people aligned, it increases energy, it does all kinds of stuff. So performance comes from culture. Culture fundamentally comes from the visible behavior of the leaders. So what are they What do they endorse? What do they punish? What do they recognize and pay attention to? What do they ignore? And a lot of this is, you know, it's not big formal communication. It's eyebrow raises and head nods or shakes, or it's implicit communication. So culture comes from unconscious behavior of the leaders. That's what creates the status quo. That's what makes you think, what are things like around here? And the unconscious behavior of the leaders comes from their mindset and their emotions. So if you want to perform, you sort your shit out. because it has a systemic impact, you know, on those.
So I know in your day job now that you obviously do this kind of coaching for people in business. I mean, I guess, is it mainly leaders that you're focusing on? Is it mainly...
Just because they have a bigger sort of systemic, they have the power to mess other people's lives up quite spectacularly.
Okay.
So if you get leaders to be a bit more authentic, then you make the world a better place.
And what does that look like then? You know, what does it look like? Is it like having a therapist working with you?
Completely. You know, leadership therapy. I don't know. I spent years being an executive coach and then having a 1 day a week therapy clinic in London, being a therapist. It was almost like never the twain shall meet. These two very different identities, Daryl the hypnotherapist, Daryl the exec coach or company director or consultant or whatever. And I think probably because of COVID, but I really feel we're in a world now where I can just say it's coaching and therapy all at the same time. And I think there is now the awareness that we need it.
Yeah. And have you noticed that this year? I mean, obviously, you know, it's been a very, you know, it's obviously been an unusual year. And I mean, I've been quite openly saying, you know, I'm a proper Gen X. You know, I've grown up working, you know, I'm not exaggerating, but I think my first job at 16 was 6 days a week and must have worked 6 days a week for the first 5-6 years of my career and with very little holiday. And you know, I've never really come close to burning out ever. That's just not a thing for me, right? I've always been used to working very hard and mentally dealing with that as well. But even I feel like this year I've been pushed, you know, maybe it's because of the amount of screen time and the amount of isolation, but there's definitely, because it's not just been the length of work. But I've been thinking if it's been hitting me as hard, then it must be hitting others even harder, right? Because... you know, life is a lot more, you know, there is a lot less resilience generally out there for most people, I believe. So what's the biggest impact that you've seen this year, would you say?
This year?
Do you think things have changed this year? Do you think it's always been a problem and there's no real difference, or do you think?
I'd answer that two ways. One would be to say, you know, you're never done, right? You're never zen, because, you know, if you get sorted, life will present you with a new emotional challenge that you haven't dealt with before, and it will knock you sideways. And you know, even over the last, if I could go back 5 years, I was in this sort of absolute bulletproof place of perpetual happiness and calm. And in the last 5 years, I've been off kilter, like really badly. And I think it's okay. You know, we're not perfect. You know, it's about recognizing that and having a way to get back on track, if you know what I mean. So it's like weeding, you know, you could do it as much as you like, they still come back, you know, there are still things, things to present themselves. But I think this year, you know, as human beings, we have fundamental needs. We need contextual stimulation, you know, we need the scenery to change, we need aliveness and things that we can engage with. We need self-determination, right? We need to make our own decisions and have our own boundaries and have intentions and make choices in the world. And we also need human connection, you know, and that human connection that happens when you are just in the presence of someone that you care about or someone that you are connected with, you know? And all of those things got violated this year. You know, we've been in lockdown situations, especially in, you know, in agency world, the amount of people that have been working from home is huge because we can. So we've had a lack of contextual stimulation. We've had a fundamental lack of self-determination. You know, we can't do this and we can't do that. And there are, you know, whatever you think of the guidelines and being sensible about stuff, the human impact is still very, very negative, you know, irrefutably. And we've also not been able to spend the quality time with the people that we need to.
And have you seen in particular, like, sort of certain things come up then as a result of that or not? Has there been sort of a repetition of certain things or not really? Is it still just the same?
So the behaviors that I'm seeing in all those three dimensions. So from a contextual point of view, from stimulation as well point of view, people are becoming less spontaneous. So you make a spontaneous suggestion, people are a little bit more rocked. They're a bit, oh, hang on a minute, that's not in my diary. Because we've become very familiar with a lack of spontaneity, you know, and a huge degree of predictability.
Interesting.
From a self-determination point of view, people have become apathetic. So it's like, well, there's no point doing that now. There's no point planning this. There's no point thinking about that. I'll just wait until whatever. Not realizing that mindset, again, do that for more than 6 months, it becomes pervasive. And then when opportunity comes to do stuff, can you? You know, I used to label.
Yeah, it's turned into a habit almost.
Yeah. And then the worst of all, the one that really stuck with me is just that lack of human connection. And it's deeply down to certain key important relationships in your life. You know, and I've been thinking about people who, you know, imagine if you joined an organization during this, you know, you're working with people you've never met.
Yeah.
Question: how robust the relationships will be when you've never had that.
Well, that's a question I wanted to ask you, because I know that you're very big on cultures and you know, there's obviously the big shift for people to, you know, to work more remotely and obviously flexible first. I think, you know, like some of the latest reports I've seen, you know, 90% of employees want to have don't want to be in the office full time. They want to have a truly flexible approach. And obviously, if you do have this kind of remote, flexible approach where before you maybe, and I've got a couple of clients who have got incredible office cultures, you know, people, they have flexible working, but most people want to go to the office because they miss their colleagues or they love the interactions with everybody. And I guess the biggest threat to every agency of them becoming more distributed or more agile and more away is that they're not going to be much uniqueness if the culture's not there anymore, because that's what sets businesses apart, isn't it, the culture?
Yeah, and I think there is always a culture, whether you like it or not. I mean, there'll be a culture now, even in a remote world. And in fact, worryingly, you know, there is this, there's a lot of Zoom fatigue is always on, you know, and there are no organizations out there that are saying to their people, you know, now that you're not commuting and you're not going to the coffee shop or whatever, you are expected to be constantly available for 8 hours a day on your instant messaging platform, whatever that is. No one's saying that, but people are feeling that. You know, there is this massive kind of implicit communication. And you know, they message someone as if they are sitting there waiting.
Yeah, I think the economic insecurity must be playing a part on that, though, because, you know, I think genuinely people, you know, they see the media, you know, whether it's COVID or Brexit or whatever, there's a lot of negativity out there. And so all of a sudden unemployment's rising. So people probably will be, you know, always on, because inevitably, I mean, I noticed this, Daryl, with a lot of the founders when COVID first struck, was actually a lot of them, you know, that sort of you're the one that taught me this, are you motivated by, you know, a goal or by fear or a bit of both? And suddenly the fear kicked in, and I saw owners really performing in ways that they never had before or since I'd worked with them, being amazing, like just stepping up and leading and inspiring and you know, coming up with positive plans to which maybe they hadn't been doing before. They needed the fear to motivate them. And I wonder whether you're right that that people are all on, but maybe there's still a little bit of insecurity driving that. And I wonder, as things settle down again, then will the cracks appear, you know?
Yeah, I mean, I think you're right. And I think the fallout will come later. You know, the thing that worries me is that, you know, lockdown will end, but that all the habits and lockdown mindsets won't. You know, we've got a bit of recovering to do, but a bit of kind of reorienting ourselves with a fully alive experience.
Yeah. That's really fascinating. I was saying that to my wife yesterday. I was saying there's going to have to be a period of readjustment almost, because when I came out, you know, we do these mastermind groups. And we did I'm going to get you to come along actually and talk to one of them, because as you're so local, because it's in the Four Seasons, literally less than a mile from where you live. So, and there was, you know, like 15 people in the room, and I had to talk to everyone, and I haven't really spoken. I've actually done two of the groups now, but I haven't spoken to a team of people, you know, for quite a few months. I haven't spoken at all publicly for, you know, probably since early stage of this year. And so I felt like I'm not match fit. Like I didn't feel like I was kind of like, you know, there's going to take time for me just to tune back into all of those things. You're so right in what you say there. I think that period of readjustment is going to have to be something that, because often, you know, when people are off work for periods of time, Daryl, I've noticed over the years, I'm sure you have as well, that if someone has they go on a sabbatical, or, you know, they're off for medical reasons, or they have a baby or whatever, or paternity leave, actually there is an element of readjustment. Confidence goes a little bit, and often you have to help people support back into the working place. So I guess we've got a lot of that to come up as well next year.
It's a lot of reorienting yourself with the new world, whatever that is, you know.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So they're the things that you can help people out with, basically.
I'm expecting to be busy. I hope to be busy anyway.
Yeah, I think you will be. I think definitely there's going to be a lot of fallout really next year from all of this year. A lot of people are going to need to sort their heads out a little bit and get them back in the game for sure. So what are your plans now then? So you're going to be doing this coaching moving forwards. And how does that, just out of interest, how does that work?
So
was it 1 day a month you said you work with people, or how does that?
Contact time plus some calls and some support stuff. And I might run some surveys and do some admin around the edges of it. But it's a day a month of contact time. And then I look for people to commit for 6 months, because I think, you know, you've got to commit to this stuff.
It's a journey, right? You can't just fix someone in an hour. You can't just fix someone on a train in 30 minutes. Well, actually, no, you can, but I'm sure sometimes it's more complicated than that.
One thing on a train. But, yeah, I think, to really, you know, to create some great deep transformations that stick around for a while, you know, I think 6 months is a bit of a minimum. And then, you know, if people don't have the bandwidth or whatever, or they want to get a little further, a little faster, I'm running immersive experiences. So I'm doing a 6-day at the end of January, which I'm so excited to do, because, you know, almost like selfishly. But
so what's that you're doing?
I'm running an NLP program.
Okay, so you're basically, so you're not, obviously, you're now you're teaching people to do NLP. That's kind of, now you are an NLP Jedi Master. You basically then run coaching. So if anyone is interested in basically learning to, you know, to be able to use NLP in their leadership role, that would be ideal for them, I guess.
Yeah, it's going to be self-application. You know, it's very immersive, 6 days in a lovely location with a small bubble of 12 people. So I mean, just that experience alone is going to be fantastic after the year we've had. But yeah, it'll be a lot of self-application. So how to hypnotize yourself, if you like, or how to sort your own mindset out, how to be a bit more self-aware about some things, and then a few tips and tricks for presenting and for coaching other people. And so it's sort of practitioner level training on a sort of 8-hour a day, 6-day week.
Wow, that's pretty tough going. So that's good. And so when you spoke on stage, it feels like a lifetime away now, but it probably was only last year. And you shared a very simple technique that you had learned for people to be able to get themselves into a meditative state really quickly. And funnily enough, someone quoted this back to me about a week ago. So I used the Daryl technique from your event, and I was reminded of it. And actually, to be fair, I have used it a few times when I've particularly needed just to switch off quickly. Do you mind sharing that with people? It's probably quite hard to do it live, isn't it? Especially when they're driving their cars, listening to this on their podcast.
If you're driving, do not do this.
Disclaimer, yeah. Turn the volume down now if you're driving.
I think for a day, just just a way of, I mean, for years I was bedeviled by this idea of what's the minimum thing that you need to do to get into a really cool state. And also, how do you make it part of your everyday life? Because if you've got to go and put yourself in an isolation tank or, you know, go in a quiet room and turn all the lights off, it's not particularly practical. You know, you need to be able to do it on a train or in between meetings or whatever else. So how do you sort your state out easily? And a lot of the misconception with sort of hypnosis or mindfulness or getting into really cool states that rebalance your nervous system and allow you to physically let go of some tension and whatever else. But the myth is that it's about not doing things, you know, stop thinking and clear your mind and switch this off and stop that. And you can't not anything. You know, if I say don't think about beans, you obviously...
About beans.
So, you know, as we all know. So, you know, the intention of not doing something is just a ludicrous intention. So what you have to do is think about what to do, you know, how to guide your consciousness, how to fill it up, how to utilize that. So the technique is, for anyone who wants to play, is to sit still. So, and when I say sit still, it means resist the temptation to fidget or move. You know, it's very, very unusual for us to really sit. We're always sort of consciously orienting ourselves with. So actually just stopping and sitting still is quite a change and a transformation. People don't afford themselves the opportunity to do that very often. The second part of the technique is to fix your vision somewhere comfortable and allow it to rest there and stay stuck in the same spot.
I'm trying this.
If I
just fall asleep or zone out, everyone, just please, you know.
I'll tell you a story about that in a moment. And so the second thing is to fix your vision. And then while your vision is fixed, then allow it to widen. You know, just allow yourself to become more aware of things to the left and right. So the first part of the game is to choose three things you can see independently. So it's what's directly in front of you, maybe something to the left, something to the right, but three independent things. And without moving your vision, like keeping your vision central, cycle your attention between those things until you can hold all three of them at once. And then when you can do that, then pay attention to three things that you can hear and now hear through your ears. So be aware of three things three sounds around you, three different ones if you have three different sounds around you. And then the third step is to be aware of three things you can feel. So how the back of your chair feels about your back or anything else, and how your feet feel against the floor or how your bum feels against the seat. And even better if you can bring it to an internal awareness, so how you're breathing because you are, and how your shoulders feel or whatever else. So pick three things you can feel, three bits of your body, feel them all at the same time as becoming aware of the three things you can hear and now see differently, so the left, the right, and the center, and you should be able to begin to notice your attention has changed.
It does work, it does, because slowly but surely everything then was just shutting down and quieting down. So hopefully some of you will go and try that. Three things that you see, three things that you hear, and three things that you feel are really at the core of it. And it is quite rapid. Like when I tried it the other day, again, it seems to work quite quickly. Like within 30 seconds, you can almost be in a very still, calm place. Correct?
Correct. Yeah, it's a lovely, and you could do it anywhere, any place, anytime. Do it on the tube train. Do it in a meeting room. Just to recenter yourself.
So Pete asked this question the other day, can you hypnotize someone over Zoom? And you said it's not that easy to do, actually. Probably just as well, really.
It's easy to hypnotize someone over Zoom. It's not so easy to do really precise hypnotherapy over Zoom because it's just easier when you're in the room.
Too many distractions. And so the question that I wanted to ask you around that has just gone out of my head. It was around face-to-face. Oh, gosh, where was I going? So, okay, I have to come back to that one because it's just completely – I think you've put me into such a zen state now that I feel like I'm just floating around and feeling very, very calm.
I did a gig a year or so ago, just over, with my friend Leon, who I think you met, the Olympic medalist guy.
Yeah.
It was about 250 people in the room. And it was in a cinema in Leicester Square. We did it. And for a large media company. And I did that game, you know, I got everyone in this, you know, completely tranced out state. So 250 people, and wow. The game was like a mill pond. You know, you got them because all of the movement stops. Everyone becomes absolutely still. And but then the crazy thing is, then you say, "So, how was that?" And you can't get anything from
everyone's like so zen and sort of zoomed out. I do feel a bit like that, I have to say. It's quite nice. You almost forgot where I was then for a minute. We're actually live on a vodcast, so I really should probably snap back out of it now. Or you secretly hypnotized me. So cool. So yeah, what else can we talk about, my friend? What else? I think you need to interview me now.
I'll take over for you.
Yeah, can you do that? Can you do that?
Attention to this stuff. What do you think? What's your experience? What do people think?
I think, you know, I mean, it's interesting, really, because I remember going on a leadership course many, many years ago when I worked in retail. And at the end of the session, the guy said to us, I want to try something a bit different with you now. Bearing in mind, I was like a general manager in a PC World store. And he basically sat us all down at the end and he started to do the same a similar exercise to what you've just done, really. Effectively, he was trying to do some kind of meditation with us all, and we were all like giggling like kids and just like all trying to be a bit too cool. And it's funny because up until that point I hadn't really had any experience of meditation. Nowadays the whole world, you know, understands basically meditation and the benefits really of sometimes just quieting the voice in your head, and you know, and actually the resilience it can give you. Last year I was probably meditating about an hour a day. I was actually really getting into it. And when I say an hour a day, I mean at least 45 minutes to an hour every day. And I found that I was I couldn't be emotionally upset for a lot longer periods of time. You know, it was like I could go through a whole day and no matter how much. Yeah, because listen, being a non-exec, and you know this, being, you know, helping people, it is a difficult job. You know, people have bad days at work. And when you have lots of clients, you know, you pretty much guarantee that in any one day someone's ringing you up, you know, with some kind of challenge and problem and stress, which you have to absorb. You know, you absorb their energy, you absorb their frustration. So I think I've been a massive fan of this, you know, from almost taking the piss out of the guy, making us all do what seemed like some weird form of yoga or sort of Buddhist meditation, to actually, you know, becoming pretty good at doing it and actually seeing the benefits that it can have. But it's just trying to find ways for, you know, and the last, weirdly, I've had all this time through COVID, but I've seemed to have less time to meditate. I don't know why that is. It's almost like I'm at home now. I've got more time, but I'm doing less of it. Maybe it's because there's always someone at home. I don't know. It's a very weird, weird shift. But, sorry.
How long do you need?
Well, that's the other problem, you see, because you sound like Mrs. G now, because she's like, we're like, and you just taught us a technique that gives you 5 minutes. But for me, you know, I really enjoy like the long meditation of 45 minutes. And it's in my head, I've convinced myself that it has to be 45 minutes. And the reason for that is, and I don't really understand all the technical stuff, you probably do more than me, but as a kid, I used to have that thing where you have, you know, where you'd kind of have like, well, I was always told sleep paralysis, but I never know. But, you know, I would be in theta, right? So I was asleep, but I was awake. You know, if anyone else out there knows that feeling. And that is theta, isn't it, Daryl? Get my terminology right.
I don't know.
You don't know, but it's a bit like almost like before you're asleep, where sometimes, you know, you kind of feel like you're awake, but actually you can't move your body. And that kind of space, that's where I get to after about 45 minutes or about half an hour I get there. And I love it. And when I'm in that true stillness, that place, that's the bit where, that's why I always try and meditate for long periods of time. Because just being calm for 5 minutes is not enough for me.
Sleep and wake is a delicious experience, isn't it? Well, I think when you're coming out, obviously, you know, you go to a paralysis when you sleep to stop you flailing around all the time. And then as you come out of sleep, you can, you know, physical paralysis can last a few seconds longer, which is a really scary experience. There's a really good book by a woman called Susan Blackmore called Seeing Myself. If you're interested in like out of body experiences and weird stuff that happens when you sleep, it's a really, really good one. But Yeah, I think that there are these lovely sort of moments, but when you do that thing where you wake up in the morning, you go back to sleep, and then you have a really profound dream, and you feel like you've been asleep for an hour, but when you look at the clock, it's only 10 minutes, 5 minutes.
Yeah.
And I think it's kind of the same with meditation. You can get into, you know, the temporal rules in there are different. You know, you don't need as long to make something happen in that state as you do in your waking state.
I think that's really good advice. I think it's good for me because I think like all of us, we get to be creatures of comfort. We like to do things in the way that we do things. And sometimes we think our set ways are the best, right? I don't know. But it's like you do that. And I've got to think of it more like my Peloton, right? Where I can jump on it for a 10-minute ride, a 20-minute ride, or an hour and a half.
Yeah. This is one of my friends, Mark's a yoga teacher. And he says, you know, you get people who won't come to the yoga shala or, you know, aren't making time. He'll, you know, sort of when he coaches them, he'll get them to contract to just rolling out the yoga mat. So he comes to the shala, roll out the yoga mat. Once you've done that, you can roll it back up and go away if you want. But of course, inevitably, when people have rolled out their mat, they stick around for a bit. But it's just getting over that inertia. Like, what's the minimum ritual that you can commit to, because it would be crazy not to, that gets you into the game? You know, and so what is that? What is that smallest of actions that initiate the behavior you're after?
So the thing that I was going to ask you earlier on, which I got rattled a bit with my attempt to try and meditate while I was talking to you and shut down my brain, which kind of worked, was actually about the subject of mismatching. Because it's a phenomenon that I never really experienced ever in my life until I started, I guess, helping other people, you know, in the job that I do now. When you suddenly in a position where you're trying to, you know, mentor or coach or advise or consult other people, sometimes they will say the opposite. So I remember I was actually about 6 months in, and I started to explain some of the things that I did that really, really worked in my business. Yeah. And the person opposite me was disagreeing with everything I said, like everything. And then I noticed the pattern. And I think I remember telling you, it was really weird how this person, it was just seemed to be like, they're asking for my help, but they didn't really want to listen to what I had to say. And that's fine, right? Because, you know, I'm still getting paid for my time. But obviously that doesn't excite me, because I'm excited by people getting results. And I think you said to me, try saying the opposite. So I went back to that meeting. It was actually in Farnham, so I remember where it was. And the next time, and I said the opposite to what I believed. And the person agreed with my original point. And then I thought, well, this is a bit peculiar. Maybe this person's just a one-off. And then I guess as I've gone through the last 10 years, and, you know, it still will come up probably once a month. And it's not that anyone's necessarily bad. It's just that sometimes there's, you know, some kind of psychological challenge going on where the juxtaposed position seems like the, you know, confrontation needs to be there. And anyway, we went mountain biking the other day, Daryl, and you shared me a wonderful story. I wonder if you could share it with the listeners about if anyone out there has ever experienced when they're working with one of their team members or a colleague, you know, maybe who just always takes the opposite point of view, an approach that you had to dealing with that.
Yeah, I mean, I think the thought process behind it is people are never, ever motivated by your reasons or your arguments. They're only ever motivated by their own. You know, they do things for their own reasons. So the other thing is, a lot of people like the debate. They don't just want to be told. They want to kick it around a bit. But I do think that and this is such an important thing in all aspects of business, and you know, it's a fascinating thing when you start to observe it. But communication is like a fulcrum. In that, as soon as it becomes mismatched, it becomes more mismatched. So it's like the Statler and Waldorf thing from the Muppets. I'm sure my age now, probably no one knows who Statler and Waldorf are. But
the two guys who used to sit up in the side bit.
And then the Muppet Show would go on.
And they'd moan at everything.
Yeah, and they'd heckle and stuff, right? And
then the old two.
One of them would go, "Well, that was okay," and the other one would say, "Yeah, it wasn't too bad." And then the other would say, well, look, I really thought it was okay. And the other goes, well, it wasn't really that good. And he goes, well, no, it was. I mean, there was some really good bits. No, I think it was okay. And in the end, they're like, it was fantastic. It was rubbish. You know, and they push themselves to these polarized extremes, because that's what happens when we enter a sort of fractured interaction. But I think two things I'd say. One is, quick story. There's a guy that I study called Milton Erickson, and you study him when you study NLP. He's a really fascinating wizard who used to rehabilitate schizophrenics, an amazing sort of therapist, amazing hypnotist. But he grew up on a farm in Wisconsin, I believe, and when he was young, he used to watch the farmhands try and pull the horses into the paddock, or the corral, as they would call it in America. And so these guys would have hold of a horse, you know, with the reins coming out from the front of his nose, and they'd be tugging this horse to try and yank it into the paddock. And, you know, if you've ever seen a man on a horse, you know who's going to win that tug of war. And he was used to find it an interesting game. So he would go out and try and pull the horse away from the paddock. And then, of course, when the horse won, he would just shut the gate. it's kind of a difficult game to play in conversation, because you've got to get over your own kind of desire to be right, or your own desire to say the correct thing, and realize that it's more about the outcome and the influence than the specific things that are said in the conversation. But I think the most common application I have for it is when people come into therapy and they're really, really absolutely convinced about their opinion. They're absolutely stuck in it. And to oppose it is just pointless. Absolutely. So people might say, you know, something like, I get this feeling like, is this all there is? And you can try and sort of break that apart and say, well, what do you mean? You know, is what all there is? Or is all there is to what? What are you talking about? And that doesn't work, because it's not really a logical thought process. It's a feeling. And so there's no point trying to deconstruct it that way. And there's no point trying to sell them the splendor of the world or the wonder of the universe and say, what do you mean this is what it is? Look how lucky we are. Look at our standard of life. Look at all these things you can do. Pointless, because they're stuck in their state. So the only way around it, or the most effective way around it, is when someone says, is this all there is? I tend to just do a big sigh and go, yeah. They then go, well, hang about, you know, but it can't be. What do you mean? Well, there must be more to life like that than this.
You go, no, this is it.
What are you talking about? So they end up convincing themselves of the opposite of their own.
Interesting, right.
Exactly. So, you know, if someone says something that's a little bit off kilter, exaggerate it. You know, say the same thing more, you know, and they'll very, very quickly retract a reasonable position. Good fun to play with language. But I think it's that.
We are complicated things, aren't we, human beings? I mean, it sometimes feels like it's quite complicated, this stuff, isn't it? It's like, it feels like it should be a lot simpler to me. But our brains and our whatever it is, our ego, there's always this battle of a voice in our head telling us, you know, not to go to the gym, or not to eat the right foods, or it goes the other way, obsesses about going to the gym and eating the right food. And it's funny, isn't it? It's just is that a strange thing to say, or does that seem like a very normal thing to say?
Yeah, it does. And I think, because I think we're really simple, but I think to get to the point where you see it simply takes, you have to go through such a journey to get there. And I've always been frustrated by human science generally, that gives you snippets. You know, imagine we're in a, I don't know, we're in a bar, and there's a works party happening in the same bar. And we're a load of human scientists watching this party. Well, the economist will say that everyone's behavior that they're observing is being driven by, like, availability and price and who's paying their wages and all that kind of stuff. The sociologist will say that it's culture and just the way things are done around here. And the psychologist will say that it's to do with their ingrained personality types and something to do with their personal history, probably. Or the psychotherapist will say it's, you know, because they wanted to sleep with their mum, or and go architecturally digging into their past. And all of these people think that they're studying entire human beings. They don't realize that actually they're just studying their model. You know, yeah. studying an aspect of humanity based on a set of assumptions that their field of endeavor provides in advance. And it takes a lot to go around all these different fields and look at all these different factors, you know, cognitive biases and emotional reactions and unconscious desires and different aspects of what it is to be a human being and join them all up. And when you get to that point, it gets ridiculously simple. You know, people are just so incredibly simple in their behavior. But I think it takes a long time to get there.
I think that's really nicely put, actually. And I think a lot of people as well are always chasing, you know, a state of something, you know, a state of bliss. But, you know, it's funny because I guess I've always been, you know, I feel like, you know, from being young, for me, it was always trying to chase a sense of not being a failure. Like for me, a lot of things always stem from childhood, doesn't it, Darren? I think it's always you get left with some things in life that you need to prove that you're not. But actually, when it came down to me suddenly realizing where happiness was, it's amazing how it just comes from the moment. The moment you just stop and you just appreciate everything you have, no matter how small or how big it is, you know, is the moment actually that you get happy, because you're grateful for what you have and not for what you don't have. And, you know, and what you have is a lot less than others and a lot more than many. And so, you know, I think you're right. I think the simpler you think about things, I'm getting signs of 5 minutes left here on my left, sorry. The simpler that you can think about it, I think the easier life gets, you know, in a way. Yeah, this is what you're trying to say.
Yeah, I think so. Yeah, and you know, with all of the sort of psychology stuff and the things that come from your childhood, you say, you know, definitely, you know, there are hugely formative experiences that happen in our life. But the question that's interesting is, how are you still doing that now? You know, at 30 whatever years old, or you know, how are you still doing that reaction from when you're seven? How are you still thinking that thing that you thought when you were four? How are you? So it's, you know, the game really is not, you know, shit happens, right? You know, life happens. We've all had a story. The question is, how are you still doing it today?
I had someone recently say to me, you know, something along the lines of, you know, please don't ever criticize me when we're working together, because I used to get really badly criticized when I was younger, and I, you know, and I don't handle it very well. And I was thinking to myself, there must be a way to fix that, you know, because can you go through life, you know, not being able to, I mean, it's like, I never criticize people. I'll always be supportive, but it's like, you know, but it's funny, isn't it? How we'll carry some of that baggage sometimes for many years and not really seek to fix it, or maybe the person has tried to fix it but it hasn't worked. I don't know. Do you fix that sort of thing as well?
Yeah, but you know, we're back to that thing that I said earlier about, if you defend your limitations, you get to keep them.
Yeah, okay. Is that, well, yes, exactly. So
about, like, mental health,
no harm in having a conversation with someone like you though, anyway, if you do feel that somewhere in your life, your business life, professional life, that you're being held back. That's the key point of this show today, really, I think, is seek out Darryl and say to him, this is what I do, can you fix it, or is it unfixable? At least ask the question, I guess.
Yeah, everything's changeable if you want to.
That's, yeah, again, yeah, if you want to. This is a good point. So it's been a delight talking to you. I'm so sorry about the incredible technical hiccups this morning, but we will find a way to get you back in the studio and for phase two of this, because I'll probably like to go into a lot more detail and ask you a lot more other questions as well. So I really appreciate you giving up the time this morning, Darryl, for us. Hope you have a lovely Christmas. And thank you to everyone listening today. I hope you've enjoyed that. I hope somewhere along the line you've been able to relate to this episode, connect to it in some shape or form. And, Darryl, how do people get hold of you? We'll put all the details in the show notes.
Through the Agency Knowledge community.
Of course, yeah. So Darryl has just joined our community as our resident expert. So if you're in the community, do that. Otherwise, Darryl Scott on LinkedIn, but also we'll put the details in the show notes. So thanks everyone much. I hope you've enjoyed the episode. And that is a wrap.